Welcome to this week's episode of the Krakenbacks podcast. This week, we're diving deep into the realm of sports performance and knee pain with Dr. Dale McDonald. As the go-to doctor for all things knee pain at Elite Sport Performance in Calgary, Canada, Dr. McDonald is here to spill his secrets on getting you back to your favorite activities pain-free. Whether you're gearing up for a marathon, planning your next cycling tour, or just trying to walk around the block pain-free, we've got the inside scoop. So ready to trade in that knee pain for a new personal best? Tune in and join us on the Krakenbacks podcast this week and this can't-miss episode with Dr. Dale McDonald.
Hey, Dale. Great to see you. And I haven't seen you forever. Last time it was in Canada, but we were at a Crankworx event, I think it was. And that's right. So, but it's great to have you. And I want to make a quick intro, even though we just had the intro, that you're one of the top sports, extreme sports docs of Canada. You do a lot of work with Red Bull. You do a lot of work with the Asterisk Medical team and pro motocross and supercross and all that. I want to start with the collaboration because a lot of people think of us as back doctors and they don't think of us working extreme sports and they don't, especially extreme sports where people don't really come in with, oh, my back hurts. They come in with a broken bone. So let's talk about that. What's your role in these extreme events and your views on collaboration?
Right. Thank you. Well, I appreciate the opportunity to chat with both of you guys this morning right out of the gate. And, you know, my involvement with some of these extreme sport things just comes honestly out of my own experience being kind of an athlete and more than that, being a good crasher. I definitely ran short on talent.
I think you crashed when it came to these sports. Riding in Epa Whistler. I think you crashed.
Oh, no, no. I crashed all the time. And when you have that sort of skill set of crashing, you know, you realize pretty quickly on that you better find something else to do for a living. And it's worked out really nicely. I raced motocross as a kid, as a teenager. I even raced pro for a year, about a year. And I was making hundreds of dollars a weekend, not thousands. So that doesn't pay the bills. And I kept getting hurt. I'd go to the race on Sunday, wad myself into a dozen pieces, and then go to the family doctor and the chiropractor on Monday morning to patch me back together. And, you know, it was kind of just pretty obvious that I wanted to keep going to school and I wasn't going to make any money as a rider, mountain biking or motocross. So it just ended up being kind of an interview process, truthfully. I went to my family doctor and interviewed him in high school. And I went to my chiropractor as well. And my family doctor, lovely guy, but overweight, out of shape, divorced, depressed, didn't like his job. And he said to me, his literal words, verbatim, were, if I had to do it all over again, Dale, I'd be a chiropractor. And I was like, really? And he's like, I asked, well, why is that? He said, well, you make at least as much money. Your patients actually like you. And you're not dealing with depression and terrible diseases all day long. And I thought, okay, that's compelling. Yeah. I went to my chiropractor shortly thereafter, and a young, fit family man who'd never woken up in the morning and not wanted to go to work. Yeah. And I thought, well, that's settling it right there. Wow. I mean, in hindsight, I wish I'd known that ophthalmologists existed as a specialty because, you know, they make more money. But for me, it's the combination of profession and passion. And to be able to blend those two things together, as both of you guys probably live, that's the sweet spot. So now I get to go to races that I was never good enough to compete in. I get paid more than I ever got paid as a racer, and I don't get hurt. So it's win-win-win.
So good to meet you, Dale.
Yeah, thank you.
I want to know how you came upon becoming a chiropractor and distilling everything down into your specialty in the knee. Because everybody thinks chiropractors are spine, and that's not, especially if you're a sports injury guy, that's not the case.
The College of Chiropractors in Canada offers five different specialties. After you become a chiropractor, you can go into clinical sciences, which is to be a researcher. You can do the radiology fellowship. You can do physical medicine and rehabilitation, basically, physical and occupational rehabilitation. You can do orthopedics, or you can do the sport medicine one. And in Canada, the sport medicine one is the one that has the most traction. It's offered as a external residency program through a few of the different universities in Canada, wow. And as well as the chiropractic school. And University of Calgary, which is where I live now in Calgary, was one of the schools that offered this. And it was sort of a pilot project between University of Calgary Sport Medicine, Faculty of Medicine, Faculty of Kinesiology, and the Chiropractic School in Canada. And I knew I wanted to take my chiropractic training kind of as far as I could. So I started doing this sports sciences residency program under a guy named Greg Uchaz. He's one of the sports chiropractors here in Calgary. And he was great for me to work under. I got to participate in a lot of unique sports. He was the doc for the Olympic bobsled and skeleton teams at that stage. And even in my first year of my residency, he's like, okay, off you go to Europe. Let's have you go and just work with these Olympic bobsledders and skeleton athletes. And that was a cool opportunity to start with. And I go to knee rounds at the University of Calgary Sport Medicine Clinic every Wednesday back then. And because Canada has public health care, we have something called the Acute Knee Injury Clinic, which is a publicly funded sport medicine knee clinic at University of Calgary. And it's an amazing clinic. They do great. Because they're acute knee injuries only, they see only acute knees, so 6 weeks or fresher. And every Wednesday at knee rounds, the clinicians who run this clinic, a few orthopedic surgeons and a few sport med physicians, would spend the better part of the knee rounds complaining about their wait times because Alberta Health Services back then, which is our parent sort of public governing body, set a mandate that they should be able to see an injured knee within 72 hours of that person phoning the acute knee injury clinic. And by their own admission, they were meeting that criteria 1.2% of the time.
Oh my God.
Like 1.2% of the time. So if they were victims of their own success, and they technically still are. Like, they're really good. You just can't get in to see them as quickly as you're supposed to. And back then, it was so bad that there were people who were on the wait list for more than 6 weeks to get into the acute knee injury clinic whose threshold was 6 weeks or less, thereby kicking them right out of the list. So then they couldn't get in. It was wild. And so the light bulb came on one day for me because I was going through the same postdoc sport medicine stuff. But as a chiropractor, I have the ability to actually bill privately. Whereas in Canada, if you're a sport medicine physician in the public system, you must only bill publicly. So suddenly I had a loophole where I was the one guy with all the training, the same as them, who could do it privately. And I sent out a fax of all things, a single page fax saying, hey, private knee clinic exists. Send us your patients. We'll see them in a matter of days. I mean, the reality was I would have seen them in an hour because I didn't have many patients back then. But sent it to 1,852 family physicians in the province of Alberta. And within 10 minutes, the fax machine just started spitting out referrals. Oh. And so you're like, oh, okay, I'm onto it. And knees were really a thing of interest to me. Not at the beginning. I didn't like knees when I first graduated. But it's one of those things, and you guys have done this too, and everybody finds a point in their life where you have to lean into something that you're not good at.
Ooh, I like it. Yeah.
Because you want the satisfaction of starting to get good at it. Yeah. And once I started to get good at knees, then we tried this fax, and then you have to get good at knees in a big hurry after that. And, you know, I mean, we've been so fortunate because there are 140 to 160,000 knee injuries in the province of Alberta every year, of whom the majority either don't see anybody or they may see their family doctor. And family doctors, you know, are supposed to be very good at keeping you alive. They're not supposed to be experts with knees. And so we've slowly built the relationship with a huge network of family practices around the province to just send us their knees. And it works like a charm.
So you get this wide range of knee derangements and or problems or conditions. Yep. Because they all just come to you. And for the listening audience, how many of those, if you could provide a statistic maybe, whether it's meniscus, medial lateral collateral, anterior cruciate, posterior cruciate, how many of those actually go to surgery?
Very few. Very few. Canadians are really remiss to do orthopedic surgery unless you have to, right? And I think that probably is a difference between the US and Canada. You can find a surgeon in the States to do a surgery in the next 10 minutes. Whereas in Canada, there really are some stringent criteria on what qualifies. We have an orthopedic surgeon in our clinic, actually. And so he'll do some public consults, but then he'll have to go off and do the surgery somewhere else. We're working on trying to get a private surgical option in Canada. It's really a tricky thing because Health Canada is quite feisty about this topic, and we've got to figure out if we can. But and we were just talking about this. We just did a presentation actually to physicians and chiropractors just at the start of last week. Instead of a wine and cheese, we called it a knees and cheese, kitschy as that was. But it was just an info session on how to refer, what to refer for. And our surgeon was saying, fully 80% of the cases that he sees are referred by family doctors because the family doctor is just trying to pass off somebody who said the word knee pain. And the family doctor doesn't know much about knee pain, so refers directly to the surgeon. So he's only doing surgery on 15 to 20% of the cases that he sees. And through our clinic, what we can help with is we can filter out those people who are actually surgical from the myriad larger proportion that are not surgical. And those people who aren't surgical do great with this whole spectrum of options that we offer from a conservative standpoint.
So I don't want to lead you on the answer to this, but let me ask you for the listening audience, how many of those that you do a very thorough physical exam on that actually you would require a MRI with MRI? How many of those?
There again, we have a different sort of approach than you guys do. The same sport medicine clinic at University of Calgary, some of the surgeons will not accept a surgical referral if you've done an MRI. Just as a stake in the sand, because MRIs are so overdone by people who just rely on the image to do the diagnostic work for them. Mm-hmm. If you're good at knees and you had enough at hands-on time, you can tell what's going on without an MRI. And because Canadians are trying so hard to save money in the public health system, and an MRI in Canada is, $1,100 to the government. If they can save the $1,100 by having somebody who's good at a knee exam, it's just better to do it that way. So there are a handful of surgeons who won't take your referral if you have done an MRI. We reserve MRIs for things where it's likely to change our clinical management. So if you know what's going on, you don't need the MRI. But if you're not sure and the MRI is likely to change how you approach the case, that's the time to order it. And so we have access both publicly and privately for MRIs. And depending on whether the patient wants to wait to get it for free, the wait time presently in Calgary is 8 months, 9 months to get a free MRI, or it's tomorrow if you want to pay $650.
Good, because it blows me away that right across a border, healthcare can be viewed dramatically differently. I don't mean healthcare as far as reimbursement. I'm talking about healthcare as far as management, evaluation and management. I tell my interns all the time, it's so easy to be a great doctor because nobody puts their hands on you anymore. And then they've resorted to telemedicine. So how do you do, you're losing a very multidimensional approach. So I am so glad that you're saying this. And I think that is golden because it's just the opposite.
And what I'm hearing is everybody wants things for free. And if you want it for free, you wait forever. If you actually want to pay for it, and people think that that kind of medicine, it's great. It's just everything for free. I'm like, nothing's for free.
Yeah. It's always the equation in Canada is cost versus time. That's really the whole equation. You can get anything done by excellent doctors if you wait long enough. The wait time presently, if you want to get a knee replacement in Calgary, is about 2 to 2.5 years to get it done. And that's good. This is actually part of Alberta's new FAST program, which is a whole effort to speed things up because during COVID, it was 4 to 4.5 years to get a knee replacement. And so the trouble, of course, there is that you're sacrificing a huge section of your quality of life at a stage in life where 4 years is a big deal. And so we offer it up to patients either way, right? We can happily put them in the public queue, or we can send them privately. It comes down to what the patient's prerogative is or what their priorities are. And we don't push them either way. In fact, we can even put them in both queues and they can play the two against each other. And the nice thing for us is that, let's say we have a month wait for a public MRI, or we have a year and a half wait for an ACL reconstruction. We can use that window of time to really work hard from a conservative care standpoint. And we're good at it. So we can often get the patient better to the point that by the time they do go in for the consult with the surgeon, now they're feeling well enough that they're not sure that they need the surgery at all. And so that's one of our goals clinically, is to be able to get people off that surgical conveyor belt if we can. And the surgeons love it because then it filters out who needs surgery versus, you know, who maybe doesn't. It actually makes their time and their consult time more efficient and effective.
That's awesome. And it's nice that people are paying for stuff that they see value for.
Yeah. You know, it's how I want to see healthcare work, both personally and professionally. And the people that I have in my group, we all have this sort of vision of how collaborative care should actually work. And so we create our own little microcosm in our clinics where, you know, we actually do take our time. We don't rush, and we do charge enough that it already pre-filters who's willing to take an active role in their healthcare. Mm-hmm. So that when they come in, they have an amazing experience. They get to talk as much as they want, as long as they want, utterly unrushed, ask as many questions as they want. And then even if there was a strange scenario where we can't help them, we already have helped them because we've allowed them to feel heard. We've allowed them to ask all their questions in an unrushed environment. Whereas publicly, you know, they're in and out of the surgeon's office or the sport med physician's office in 4 minutes or 5 minutes. And maybe even 10 minutes on the high side, but that feels rush after you've waited a year to only get rushed through in 10 minutes. That's not a good clinical experience.
Dale, you would be shocked at the number of patients that come in with a knee complaint saying that their orthopedic or their medical doctor or suggested knee replacement surgery. Now, I have actually two doctors who went to orthopedics that were told they needed knee replacement. and they come in and I go, I do a thorough exam and I'm going, I can't find any. You have an IT syndrome or something like that.
Yeah.
And they get better in a week and they're back to running or chondromalacia or something like that. But
yeah. Yeah. We always sort of explain it to our patients as though there's a spectrum of options. On one end of that spectrum is doing nothing, letting natural history take its course. And maybe it gets better over time, all the way through to replacement. And then what people miss is that there are myriad options in between there. And if that's where our clinics shine, because the acute knee injury clinic can handle the really acute stuff if the person gets in. And then the orthopedic surgeons can handle the surgery or the replacements if it gets to that stage. But there is a smattering of offerings in between. And that's really where we're going. And in an aging population, that tends to be working really nicely because there are lots of people who have knees that aren't acute, but they're not surgical either. And they're just somewhere in that no man's land. And that's where we shine.
You know, on that topic, you know, we're hopefully the audience is hearing that chiropractors aren't just back doctors. Yeah. And according to, there's some podcasters out there that don't even think chiropractors are back doctors. They think there's only two doctors in the world out there, MDs and DOs. So it's nice that you're talking about that. What do you think is the, when you're evaluating the knee, what do you think is the biggest misconception or mistake that a lot of people make?
I think chiropractors are uniquely positioned in this regard because we have such good hands-on training. And you can't replace that. It's really an asset. You know, I like to think of chiropractors as, you know, the people who are experts at joints, muscles, and nerves, and the interrelationship between those three, period. And that can be true of any joint in the body. I happen to do a lot of knees, but you could just as easily be a chiropractor who has a shoulder clinic or an ankle clinic. You know, the actual training that we have, the hands-on expertise that we develop over the years, uniquely positions us to be good with joints. And I like to keep a narrow sort of viewpoint on it. I feel badly when a chiropractor tries to say that they're good at everything. I think it comes across as though they're not good at anything. And I mean that honestly. It sounds controversial, but I find naturopaths do much the same thing. You know, we've got a couple of naturopaths in our office and they're great, but just even down the street, there are naturopaths who, when you look at their window or you look at their website, it is a litany of things that they treat. And if I was the patient or if I was my mom trying to find a good chiropractor or a good naturopath, I wouldn't want to go to the person who has 80 things listed that they treat. I don't think that sends the right message. So I like the idea of being an expert at a very small number of things. Mm-hmm. I live in a big city. There's 1.2 million people in Calgary. There are plenty of people for every type of chiropractor. There's plenty of people for my style of practice. So it's a whole attitude of abundance type thing. If we get philosophical for a second, just be really good at the thing that you're doing, but pick one or two things that you're really good at. Stick with those.
So on that, let's take a typical condition that everybody complains about, runner's knee. All right. So
yes.
Yeah. Some people call patellofemoral syndrome, chondromalacia, take us through how you would evaluate that, since everybody complains about that. They'll go, oh, he's got tendonitis. You need to tape it. You need to stop running. You need to take us through how you would evaluate that.
Sure. I'll take you through it, and then I'll say something controversial at the end.
Love
that. Just to get you going. But to start with, I mean, you've got to listen to your patient, right? You've got to let them give you a full history. And actually not make presuppositions. You know, we all are guilty when we hear a certain phrase or a certain thing that the patient says, we automatically start to bolt down one pathway thinking, ah, I've got it. It's this or it's that. And we come to judgment too quickly, I think. So letting the patient actually give you a full history and then, you know, asking some probing questions and trying to get more detail out of them, because I have patients just even last week. I asked them how much pain they were having on a scale of 1 to 10, and they start talking about a totally different topic. Like they didn't answer the question. And so you've got to go back and actually try to get detailed answers to your questions, let them give you a full history, and then corroborate that with a really, really good physical hands-on exam. That's kind of it. It has to be sport specific. So you have to take into account the position that the athlete or the patient is in when they're getting the pain. Great example. I've got a pro rodeo guy that I'm treating right now, and he's got a bad leg. He's broken his leg 6 times, the same leg, and it's mangled, as you would imagine when you look at it visually. But he has no pain when he's standing upright. He has no pain when he's walking. He's only in pain when he's in his riding position. And so you've got to take that into account, because if you do your normal orthopedic exam in your normal positions, you might miss the actual causative agent of pain. So you've got to try to reproduce the same mechanism of injury, or the same mechanism of action that creates the injury. So I think sport specificity of what reproduces the pain, that's a big one. But then the thing that I'll say that is controversial is that in 2023, I really dislike the whole runner's knee, jumper's knee, patellofemoral pain syndrome, any syndrome. It's 2023. We are far enough advanced in our abilities for diagnostics, whether it be diagnostic imaging, our abilities to just be excellent with our clinical skill. I think blanket diagnoses are lazy. I really do. And so when somebody comes in and they've seen 4 or 5 or 6 different people before, and the only thing that they've been told is they've got runner's knee or jumper's knee, it doesn't mean shit. Because there are so many things that exist within the confines of what runner's knee could be. I think it's really important to get down to what is the actual pain generating structure. And so in our clinic, we have 3 pillars in our approach to care. The first one is treat the actual problem. Make sure you have the diagnosis laser correct, not an approximation, not a syndrome, not a blanket. Try to get down to the actual tissue that's causing the pain. Step 2, strengthen the area, because as we all know, the stronger an area becomes, inherently it becomes more stable, and more stability generally causes less pain than lack of stability. Thirdly, avoid or modify offending activities. So that is to say, don't screw it up worse. There's a lot of patient education that goes into that too. We all treat these type A plus 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 personalities, you know, your CrossFitters, your ultra marathoners, your Ironman athletes, the people who think that if 100 repetitions of something is good, then 1,000 must be better, right? These are bread and butter for chiropractors because they keep getting hurt. Patient education is a big one, to just not tell the person they can't run anymore. We never say that. In fact, we want to find ways to allow our patients to continue to do the things that they're passionate about. But there has to be a little bit of wisdom that creeps in where you modify the technique or you modify the volume or you just tone it down for a little bit so that we can get the proverbial head start in that tug of war between things that they're doing to make the problem worse and things that we're doing to help fix them. And, you know, they have to back off a little bit to let us win. That's why they're coming.
Dale, what imaging techniques do you use? CT or if you were ever to SPECT exams or when do you use the imaging tools and why would you do that?
The ones that we use most often, we're lucky enough to have an X-ray facility right in our building. So we can send patients there straight away and get all of the imaging that we want. And the radiologists work really well with us. So that's an easy one for us. And because we see an awful lot of degenerative joint change with an aging population, with knees in particular, we see a boatload of medial compartment, moderate osteoarthritis, for example, or degenerative meniscal tearing, this type of thing. So the X-ray, obviously weight bearing, particular views, you know, P to A and lateral at 30 degrees flexion with skyline views, these sorts of things. We do have two very sleek diagnostic ultrasounds in our office. Mm. And although diagnostic ultrasound is useless for the more internal structures of the knee, like a cruciate ligament, they're excellent for seeing joint swelling. They're excellent for posterior horn medial meniscal tears or Hoffa's fat pad fibrosis, patellar tendon tears. You can see Osgood-Schlatter's. You can see Sinding-Larsen-Johansson syndrome. You can see all these things on diagnostic ultrasound right in the clinic. And what's cool about that is the patient loves the convenience of being able to have it live while they're in the office. Mm-hmm. And they love even more the fact that you'll talk them through it, show them the images, point to here is the tear or here is the issue, because then they get it, right? Yeah. They're like, oh yes, I see it. Okay, let's go forward. So that's been a really, really useful one for us. Because we see a lot of high load athletes, we do CT once in a while. We do bone scans when we're worried about repetitive strain, you know, periosteal responses, stress fractures, this type of thing. And then I'm sure you guys have the same thing, but we do the CT SPECT exam where it's the hybrid of a CT with a bone scan that's colorized. And so it will show up the hotspot of increased metabolic activity if somebody has a occult medial tibial plateau fracture or insufficiency fracture. We see these every week. And it's great because the patient will tell you what's going on because they'll tell you that they're having night pain. That's waking them up, that it's a constant toothache type throb. And they'll point to the exact spot on the knee, and it's not the joint. It's a little bit lower or a little bit higher. And this is where clinical accuracy comes into play. You have to really pay attention because if they're just generally pointing to the joint line, you're thinking, oh, okay, maybe they've got an MCL sprain or maybe they've got a meniscal tear. But you look closely and you palpate closely, and it's not their coronary ligament. It's not their meniscus. It's their tibial plateau, or it's their medial femoral condyle. And then you can confirm with imaging, then you can take appropriate steps.
Love it. So what are the more common, I mean, gosh, we have a lot of runners down here. What are the more common conditions that you might see or common mistakes that are made in evaluating even long distance runners?
Yeah. The biggest mistake is not paying more attention to the footwear that these runners are coming in wearing. Mm-hmm. If you're an avid runner, chances are you're going to be wearing some relatively recent shoes, but mm-hmm. It horrifies me how many people come into my office with running shoes that are 4 years old, 5 years old, and they can't understand why they're having shin pain or medial knee pain. The money that they would save on me by just going and buying a $200 pair of actually good running shoes, not gimmicky running shoes, but actually good running shoes, would be amazing. And so I think, you know, I should get a basket of chocolates from the running stores around here. I send so many patients in for new shoes. And that's probably the single biggest thing that I see. If a patient has medial knee pain and they haven't done anything else, go buy a new pair of shoes first. And the thing that we advocate for our patients is something called a twist test. You know, you grab the heel of the shoe, grab the toe of the shoe, try to twist. And if you can fold it over, you're not really wearing a shoe. You're wearing a thick sock. And that gets us into a totally different topic. And maybe that's a different podcast about the research on minimalist shoes versus maximalist shoes. You know, what's the latest literature on proper footwear? But I think just strike it down the middle, get a good quality, pretty expensive, neutral shoe. And a lot of people's knee pain gets better just from that. First and foremost.
Barefoot running?
I have a patient who has a big bucket of ground up glass, and he grinds his feet in the ground up glass so that he can run in Calgary, where we have 10 months of winter and 2 months of no snow. Those are our seasons. and he runs truly barefoot 12 months of the year, and his feet are unbelievable. He's single, strangely. I can't imagine why. with feet that look like that. But barefoot running has been shown to be very good from a proprioceptive perspective. It's excellent for all the little small intrinsic muscles. It's excellent for being able to develop sensitivity to perturbations in the surface. It takes away the incidence of big toe arthritis, but instead it replaces it with arthritis in the other four toes. So when you look at the literature, shoes, shod running, will give you first toe, first metatarsal osteoarthritis, but salvages your other four. Run barefoot and you salvage the big toe, but get arthritis in the other four instead. So you pick your poison. Wow. And when we think about one of the things, you know, down in the States, you guys had a class action lawsuit for, what was it, those Vibram five-finger things. And they ended up being, from what I'd read, kind of the worst of both worlds, because they didn't give you any of the shock absorption of a normal shoe, but they didn't give you any of the proprioceptive input of being truly barefoot.
Yeah.
So you kind of need one or the other. Either be actually barefoot, which can have some benefits, or wear a real shoe that actually has some shock absorption properties, because you're giving away the proprioceptive input by wearing a shoe. You're getting the shock absorption instead. Can't have it both ways.
What do you think about those Hoko shoes or Hookie, whatever?
Hokas. Yeah, they're good recovery shoes, but that's all they were designed to be. They were originally designed to be recovery Sunday long run shoes for marathoners and ultra marathoners. That was their purpose. And now, of course, they get some marketing ideas and very rightfully have decided to make a lot more money by trying to sell to larger masses. But originally that was quite an overkill recovery shoe on purpose. That's what it was supposed to be. And So just a neutral shoe and you get what you pay for. Man, I see that one all the time with footwear. Buy a cheap shoe, you're just asking for trouble. Just spend the money, a good shoe.
An expensive article where Spencer was going to call about the 8 common mistakes made by ultra runners. What's some other of the mistakes that you talked about?
Yeah, work to rest ratios are a big one. You know, these guys, and I was a competitive runner for a number of years, and there were times where I would run twice a day, peak season, right? Like you'd run 11 times, 12 times a week. And that was obviously unreasonable, especially now that you're 40 plus, it's unreasonable. Protein degradation in a muscle peaks 24 hours after your workout. That's when you're most broken down from a protein perspective in a muscle. Protein resynthesis peaks 36 to 46 hours after your prior workout. So if you're going to be working the same muscle group, i.e. running, every other day is where it's at, because now you've given the protein in the muscle fibers the chance to actually repair. And the thing with being a runner is it's one of the very best things you can do for yourself cardiovascularly. It's one of the very best mental health things that you can do. There are so many positive attributes to running, but people start doing something, whether it's running or jiu-jitsu or any sport, they do it too hard, too often, without enough rest. And that starts to create tissue remodeling rather than tissue repair. And they're hugely different, as we all know, in terms of going down the pathway of scar tissue and adhesions and contracture and all these sorts of bad things. If you can just give your body enough time to actually repair between bouts of the same exercise, then you can actually have cellular repair and you can get all the benefits of that sport without as much of the downside. So I think that's a big one for runners, but you could attribute that to all sorts of different athletes.
That is fantastic information that I'm going to apply immediately. I always wonder what, you know, when you train really hard, you know, resistance training, not even just running, but heavy training. And then, you know, I've read some literature that you don't repeat that, that leg workout or that chest workout for a week. Mm. And it actually is effective. When back in the day, you would train, you know, twice or three, hit that same body part three times.
Yeah.
And so technology has come a long way, and science explains a lot of why and how we benefit by some of the mistakes we've made.
You know? Well, and I mean, and it's ever present, you know. I mean, whether we're talking about the science on stretching and how much that has changed, you know, people still stick to what they learned in high school phys ed, and they don't, we're busy. You don't read up on the latest stuff. Even when we get to the surgical topic with surgical management of meniscal tears, the number of surgeons that still insist on debriding a torn meniscus and taking out a swath of this thing, even though the literature is overpowering now, and this whole notion of save the meniscus, you know, don't debride it, don't scope it, don't take some of it out. It's just slow for a lot of people to actually catch up to what's out there. So whether it's the recovery part, whether it's the stretching part, whether it's the surgery part, those are just three examples of our requirements as chiropractors to stay current.
Well, actually, it's interesting you bring that up. The here in the States, they reviewed all the you know, surgeries versus physical therapy prior to a surgery, such as prehab or however you would refer to it, and found that there was a significant number, and this was actually published in mainstream media, and it was put out there that a good round of physical therapy could curb a multitude of potential knee surgeries. There's knee surgeries that were suggested here in the United States, of course. And then the question was brought up, well, why are they still doing it? Because Medicare still recognizes and grants that opportunity to do the surgery if you just say they need surgery. There's no requirement.
There are so many dark, sort of nuanced side stories that sadly rationalize the way things are done. And there are plenty of examples of it in Canada as well. And that part's a little bit sad to realize, because there's just a lot of resistance on endless levels to changing the way that things are done. That's a whole other topic.
Yeah.
You know, it seems like they also sometimes it's like it's easier to remove it than to stitch it. And the patient just wants a quick fix and get on. They don't really look at that long term, 2 years down the road, 3 years down the road, 4 years down the road.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, people, rightfully so, people like decisiveness. People appreciate decisive action. And people appreciate expediency. If the surgeon can confidently go in and say, yes, I'm going to take this part out, you're going to be great. The patient feels confident that there's actually a solution. That's sexier and simpler in a person's mind than having to really work their ass off for the next 3 months doing exercises that they don't like. And I understand that. I mean, I would empathize in a lot of situations. It's tempting to want to go the easier route, but nothing beats just getting stronger. I think, you know, if I had one piece of advice to the world, you know, if I was able to give one piece of advice to the world, it's just get stronger. Just actually get stronger, period. So many benefits result from that, from joint stability, muscle mass, bone density, mood, all these sorts of things. Like, it's just, that's the one thing. I'm lucky with our patient base. We have patients who are already pursuing a particular sport or a particular passion. So they're driven to do the things that we recommend because they have something to do it for. But in the larger population, there's some people who just aren't intrinsically motivated. And that's a much harder world to live in for them. But yeah, if there could be a way for people to just get stronger, you know, people think that stretching is going to help them. And I really get on my patient's case about this one. I'm like, if you have 20 minutes to stretch, screw stretching, spend that 20 minutes strengthening instead. Because a stronger muscle is healthier tissue. Healthy tissue is naturally more pliable, more malleable, more elastic. You'll do better from a flexibility perspective if you just strengthen than you will if you just stretch. Imagine if you're stretching, you're desensitizing the nerves around that structure, but you're not really getting any stronger. I mean, the science shows that you might get like 0.5% stronger from stretching. Like, it's less than 1% strength gain from stretching. So you're pretty much as weak as you were, but now you're less sensitive too. Being numb and weak doesn't sound like a good combination to me. I'd rather be strong and sensitive, right? I'd rather be stronger and be able to feel what's going on than to be numbed out and weak.
Yeah. So I like your suggestion, and you know, stronger can mean a lot of things to people. So, you know, is there something that you would suggest pre-surgery and post-surgery that you would say to your patients? Not so much as a philosophical, but something more definitive and that even our listeners could entertain now.
Work your ass off. Do open kinetic chain strengthening, and don't overdo the volume. You know, like the science that I read suggests you've got to work out pretty hard with pretty heavy weights. And if we're trying to avoid that notion of repetition or repetitive strain, pick, you know, one set, maybe two sets, 12 repetitions at a weight where you can barely do the 10th, 11th, and 12th repetitions with perfect technique. And that's giving you more than 90% of your strength gains from the first set. You look at the charts on sort of return on investment for sets. First set of exercise, 12 reps, by far the majority of your strength gains come from that first set. And it's not just law of diminishing returns as you go on to additional sets. It's law of precipitously diminished returns. By the time you're at the second set, you're down to single digits in terms of how much benefit you're getting from that second set versus the first one. Third set, almost nothing. Fourth set, you're just hurting yourself, really. Like, the odds of actually getting injured go up. So if you are on a schedule and if you're trying to actually get the most bang for your buck, one set, maybe two sets, 10 to 12 reps at a weight where you can barely do the 10th, 11th, and 12th set or repetitions with perfect technique.
So what?
And then you save yourself so much time.
What would be the, if you had to pick three exercises for that everybody should do for their knee to get stronger, what would they be?
That's a great question. I like the open kinetic chain style ones. I do, because I think they keep the kneecap in a much safer sort of scenario. If you do a closed kinematic chain exercise for a knee, you put an awful lot of compressive load on the kneecap. That's why that leg extension machine has been more or less blacklisted for, well, since I was in undergrad, like 20 some odd years ago. It's just not great. So I would try open kinetic chain exercises. I really like Bulgarian split squats, personally, you know, where you've got your foot behind, whether it's Romanian, Bulgarian, East Bloc split squats, let's call them that. I like those because they're very balance dependent. And I think for any knee strengthening, you want a healthy dose of proprioceptive input. So whatever open chain exercise you do, throw a wobble board underneath you or throw a pillow underneath you on your foot. Do it barefoot so that you can get that proprioceptive input. You can get that unsteadiness so that you can pick up a lot of this collateral muscle activation. And that could be a squat. It could be a lunge. It could be this split squat, things like that. But open chain, lots of focus on proprioceptive
input. For the people listening, define what you – open versus closed chain exercises. So pick three exercises and so they don't go, oh, what's an open chain? You know,
Well, I'll be simpler. I'll give you one each. Wall sits, for example, where you're sitting up against a wall and your feet are on the floor. That's a closed kinematic chain exercise because you are locked in on both ends. Open kinematic chain, you're open on the one end. You're not locked in on both. You're touching the floor, so yes, you're locked in there. But let's say you're doing a single leg squat. Simple as that. That's an open kinematic chain exercise, hard as it is, because you're only locked in on the one end. So things like this. But open kinematic chain exercises just involve your sense of balance a lot more, stimulating your proprioceptors a lot more. And that's only good for real world utilization of your knee.
So squats, lunges, or ride a bike?
Depends on what sport you want to be doing. I think you have to do all three. I like the riding the bike part. I think a bike fitting is pretty important. A lot of my patients have very expensive, fancy triathlon bikes that they're not good enough to ride, but they want it just because of the tech. And I can appreciate that. But focusing on riding technique, like spinning technique, so that you actually have the push and the pull sort of happening synergistically, I think that's talked about too little in the casual cycling community. But I think a healthy balance of all these things, truthfully, your body craves varied stimulus. And if all you ever do are bicep curls, very quickly you adapt to the point where you're not getting much neurological stimulus out of a bicep curl. If you're only a cyclist, you're going to plateau quicker than you want. And so I think, yeah, we've got to really mix it up and just have a lot of variability in the way that we train.
One of the most common open chain movements that you didn't mention, or do you even qualify, even leg extension machine would be something that most people relate to, I would imagine. So would that be a preferred?
Now, if we're talking leg extension where you're sitting and you're literally doing this one, I don't like that one because I've read some studies on just how much compressive load you can put on your kneecap with that. And I see a lot of subpatellar chondrosis in my office, people who have some erosion of the cartilage underneath the kneecap. And so I'm not a fan of that exercise in particular. I don't think it gives your leg enough opportunity to find its own neutral position. And the patella in the trochlear groove, as you're going through flexion extension, it naturally has to sort of wiggle around to find its neutral sweet spot so that you're dissipating load as broadly as possible. I think when you're stuck in the leg extension machine, I don't think you're giving your kneecap the opportunity to find its neutral.
I'm glad I asked. And now you've also almost confirmed why leg curls would not be, because some people, when they're on a bench and they're curling, their knees are grinding into the padding. And people don't realize that they need to back up or do something, you know.
Yeah. If you think back to, high school or university physics, right? If you're just rising out of a chair, you're just getting up out of your seat, or you're getting up out of a squat position, you take your upper body mass, multiply it by the length of your femur, which is the lever in this scenario, and that equals a compressive load of your kneecap into your trochlear groove. And if you're a big guy or you're a tall guy, that number can be 700, 800, 900 pounds of compressive load under the kneecap in a big hurry. And you do that a lot in certain activities, and it's not hard to imagine why people start to get premature erosion of the cartilage underneath their kneecap.
Oh, love it. That is great. Okay, now we're going to switch gears, my man. And
sure.
We are going to go into what we call rapid fire questions, which means I'm going to ask you 5 questions.
Okay.
And you're going to give me the most brief but concise and valuable answer, which unfortunately tends to never happen, because then between Terry and I, we start to ask you questions about the answer that you just asked.
Sure.
We just asked about. So are you
ready?
I'll
do it again. I'm ready.
Right. Okay. What is your best tip for stress reduction when it comes to a diet?
When it comes to a diet?
Yes.
Go for a run.
Oh, I like that. What is your best tip to warm up the lower extremities for, running? And part 2 to that is for cycling.
It's hard to warm up for a run because most other sports you warm up for by going for a run. So how do you warm up for a run? My answer, honestly, is go for a run. Because you look at Olympic athletes, look at track athletes, they warm up for their running sport by going for a run. I think that we need to warm up enough. And I think very few people warm up enough. You've got to warm up to the point where you're actually breaking a sweat in order to get your internal operating temperature up to a point where you've got better safety profiles. So I think just more warm up is always better than less. Golfers are a classic example of this. I mean, my God, where would our practices be if we didn't have golfers who didn't warm up?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I actually really appreciate that answer, because the old days it was you would throw your leg up on the bumper of a car that was nearby and you would just start doing these, stretching or, ballistic style stretching.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Come a long way.
I like dynamic stretching. I will say that. I don't like static stretching. Right. I think it's out the door, but I like dynamic stretching.
Foam rolling?
Nope.
Okay, that's not part of our questions. We'll get back to that. All right. Let's see. Being Canadian, when you walk up to your favorite pub, what do you order?
Oh, Jesus.
Jesus had a drink.
sorry. Holy yeah, wine. Sorry. Yeah. So there are two answers to that question. Almost the whole year, the answer would be a glass of water. Or Heineken, or that Heineken 0.0. Actually, I've gotten on to that. And wow. I mean, I know it's wimpy fake beer, but it actually is pretty close. It tastes pretty close. My best friend's coming to town next weekend, and so that is going to be one of my two weekend departures, shall we say. And that will be a double Jaeger on ice. Yeah. And then there'll be another one, and then there might be another one after that. but that honestly happens twice a year, because I can rarely imagine a world where the pain and suffering is worthwhile for the 3 days after. No matter how much fun I think I'm having that evening, it's not enough fun to make the pain and suffering truly worthwhile. But I'll make one, maybe two annual exceptions.
That's it.
I hate going to lecturing with you, or work going up to the you guys, because you guys hammer me. It's fun.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, I think Dr. Konzak, Clark Konzak. Yeah. And he helps with he helps me, and I help him with Crankworks and Red Bull Joyride. And yeah, he's a bit of a he's a wonderful guy, smartest man I know, he's honestly. Awesome. But he's a bit of a bad influence on me. We'll put it that way.
Tell him I said hi.
Yeah, I will.
All right, question number four. You work with a lot of extreme athletes. What is the most extreme thing you have done that you would do again, and what you would never do again?
Yeah. I do the medical for this Red Bull event called Outliers. And it's a hard enduro. It's a FIM World Championship round. It's out in the Badlands, 2.5 hours west of Calgary. So imagine the most lunar surface you could possibly think of, replete with big cliffs, rattlesnakes, cacti, and I'm not exaggerating, dinosaur bones literally sticking out of the side of the cliffs. It's incredible. This place is unbelievable. And Shane Cuthbertson, who's the promoter for this, he's a pro enduro and motocross guy here in Calgary. Unbelievable bike skills. He took me out to go and do a pre-ride of the course, so we'd figure out where to put the medical staff and where to land the air ambulance helicopter and all this sort of stuff. And I've grown up racing motocross. I'm minimally competent on a bike, and I can get my way through most things. But it was unbelievable, the stuff that he had me trying to ride up or down. The fact that I made it out of there without breaking several things is nothing short of just astonishing. I did the medical for Crashed Ice. It's another Red Bull event that used to exist. And it's where they take four people on hockey skates and hockey equipment, and they race them down an ice course with jumps. And they had a world championship for that, too. And that is something... that was wild. I saw a guy come off the start line. There's a big drop that they have, just sheer ice wall. You jump off it on your skates, and you land, and then you start the course. And this guy blew his ACL the very first moment he dropped off and landed. He hadn't even started the course yet, and he already blew his ACL. So there's some really wild stuff that I get exposed to. I love it. I got to go down a bobsled track in East Germany. They had, we called it the sport prison. This is a fun, quick little story. Back in the 80s, when East Germany was still a thing, they secretly built a bobsled track, having stolen the blueprints for Calgary's 1988 Olympic bobsled track, so that the East Germans could practice on effectively the same track. But they made it a little bit steeper, and it made the turns a little bit sharper, and they put it all within this middle of the Black Forest in East Germany, out by, it's Altenburg is the name of the place, out by Dresden. And they put it all with razor wire around it so that nobody else could use it. The big spotlights, the tall towers with security. It was a wild place. And I got to go down that track.
Wow.
And it was... Yeah, it's just like a concussion waiting to happen, yeah. Right? That sport is yeah. Wild.
Oh, okay. Let me try this next question and last question. It doesn't have as much excitement as the last one did. if there was one book that you would give a colleague that you feel inspired you, what would that book be?
Ooh, this is so politically charged at the moment. Jordan Peterson's 12 Rules for Life.
Yeah. Love that. Love that guy.
Love it.
Love that guy.
I'm actually going to go see him tomorrow. He's coming to Calgary tomorrow evening. So I'm going to go listen in. I know it's a political hot potato. I like the guy.
He's fantastic.
I like the message that he's trying to get across. And so that's a book that I think is just so simple. There's nothing that's outlandish to it at all. It's pretty basic, but I think it's good to sort of ground yourself in a few basics.
I agree.
Is it true that he got censored up there?
No, not true. It's true that they really tried and continue to try, but they don't have any way to actually censor him.
Or that he had to go to a media.
Oh, his college of psychologists in Ontario is losing the plot with him, and it's unfortunate, but there are several examples of that type of thing going on up here. It's rough.
Love that guy though. Woo.
Yep.
All right, ask your question about foam rolling.
Oh.
Yeah, so foam rolling, it desensitizes the tissue. It's very good at that, and there's a paucity of evidence to show that it does anything other than that. And so bang for your buck, you cause yourself an inordinate amount of pain for a minuscule benefit. I don't think it's worth it.
So what do you tell people to do instead? So you don't suggest static stretching, which no. You like more of a repetitive type of stretching.
I like dynamic drills. I like leg swings, high knees. Look at all these drills that you see the sprinters doing before 100 meter or a 400 meter. Right? That type of dynamic drill, it's sport specific. It emulates the motion that they're going to participate in for their sport, but it does so in an exaggerated fashion. So they go through a full range of motion. Do a static stretch and you're doing nothing but taking a Polaroid snapshot of one range and one degree in that total muscle's range of motion. Whereas a dynamic drill, you're taking the muscle through its full functional range. Add to that the fact that they have some studies where they'll take a biopsy of the hamstring, for example. And they'll measure the length of the myofibrils under a scanning electron microscope. Then they'll have the group of participants go off and do static hamstring stretches as much as they want to their heart's content for 8, 10, 12 weeks. And at the end of that, the patient can go further in the stretch. You know, if you're trying to do just how far can you reach with your fingertips beyond your toes, they can go further. So they're led to believe that it's because they're more flexible. But then they take another biopsy of the same tissue. They scan it again under a scanning electron microscope, and it's identical. The length of the individual myofibrils is identical down to the nanometer. There's no difference. So something else is happening. If the muscle's not truly longer, but the patient can go further, all that's happening is that you've numbed the area out. You've turned down the neurological gain. So you're not getting the sensory feedback of pain that we get whenever we try to stretch a hamstring. So you end up having a muscle that's every bit as tight as it was, but it's more numb. And that's a trick. So if you're stretching because you're in pain, I think that's terrific because it will make you have less pain because it will numb you out. But if you're stretching because you're tight and you think it's going to make you less tight, it's baloney. So that's where the strengthening part comes in. If you strengthen the muscle instead, you're making the tissue healthier, you're making it more malleable, more pliable, and that's going to give you better functional range of motion than stretching ever could.
All right. That's fantastic. You know, to wrap this up, because we're getting close and I want to hold you back from doing something winter related.
I'm going mountain biking, actually. I'm going mountain biking.
Perfect. Yeah. Spencer doesn't have mountain biking, so he has bridge biking.
South Florida.
Awesome. Yeah.
We're all you Canadians come down here.
I was just down in Port Charlotte actually over Easter. My mom was down there for the winter. Beautiful place. You go.
So you got the average housewife or house husband or person that's just not an extreme athlete, not a great athlete, and they have a meniscus tear. And instead, without using the open and closed chain exercise, they may have a recumbent bike in their house in their little gym or whatever. What are some of the, give them three exercises that they can probably do that right now when they turn out the podcast to get stronger?
Fair. Three exercises for a meniscal tear. Adduction, abduction with a TheraBand. Lots of groin, lots of TFL, glute med, glute min, so that you can have some of that side to side lateral stability. Those would probably be the principal ones. I would do some calf raises, honestly. We think about medial gastroc, where its insertion is, on the distal femur. It crosses the medial part of the knee, posterior medial part of the knee, and it can add to some of that medial stability. Thirdly, anything wobbleboard based, anything proprioceptive. Stand barefoot on a wobbleboard for 5 minutes, head up, eyes forward, knee bent just a little bit. Have something close that you can hang on to if you need, and just let it shake. Let it be shaky. That the shakiness is good because that's actually the demonstration that you're stimulating these proprioceptors. And that's really what we need, especially in an aging population. We're seeing people who, they lose their sense of balance as they get older, but it's a bit of a backwards story. They're not losing it because they're getting older as much as they're losing it because they're challenging it less. And so I think we need to just challenge these things more over time. And good shoes. If you're walking around your house barefoot and you've got hardwood or tile, you're asking for it. Good running shoes, maybe a custom pair of orthotics, maybe a medial unloader knee brace. We do a lot of those for meniscal tears. And it's fantastic because if you can gap open that medial compartment, create more space, now you're just not actually pounding on that medial part of the knee. You're not aggravating the meniscus more. You're just giving everything a chance to cool down. Degenerative change in a knee is not tissue specific. Degenerative joint disease, by its very name, involves all the different tissue types from the muscle around the joint capsule, the synovial lining of the joint cartilage, the bone itself, the meniscus, even the integrity of the joint fluid. All of these things are degrading as we go through a degenerative process with time. So unloading the area is a pretty key thing. And then in our clinic, we do a lot of viscosupplementation injections. So image-guided injections of Monovisc or other hyaluronic acid injections. We do a lot of PRP. We do a lot of a different version of PRP, something called N-Stride, which is, again, just a pain reduction, inflammation reduction, somewhat regenerative injection. And when we put all those pieces together, it's the combination of persistence on the patient's part to do their exercises and patience to allow our interventions to take effect. 3 months later, the patient's usually an awful lot better.
Oh, that's beautiful.
What a great,
on that, Dale, we're going to let you go ride a mountain because that was,
fantastic. Oh, God.
And I'm so glad we reconnected. I'm sorry it's been so many years, but,
Oh no, that was my fault for playing hard to get on the phone. So I apologize for that. And I've got all my extra mountain bike padding because it's downhill down in Fernie. So yeah, I've got to dress up like the Michelin Man. It. You know, it's the thing, right? Because when you have to go to work on Monday, there's more and more padding that gets added on. I look ridiculous on the bike, but I care less and less because I just want to have fun and repeat the mantra to myself: just have fun, don't crash. Just have fun, don't crash. And I do it all the time, whether it's motocross or mountain biking. I just have that going through my mind, and I say it out loud quite a lot too, just to kind of temper my my enthusiasm.
I love that.
You need to create a bubble.
Really? Oh no, absolutely. Bubbles. Yeah, absolutely. I would love. I love these accelerometers that they have for MotoGP, where those pads will actually inflate when the accelerometer picks up. They have them for motorcycle racing. I love the notion of this coming to mountain biking or motocross. If they can avoid the false set-offs, right, where you puff up and you haven't crashed. but I think we're 5 or 10 years away from guys like us being able to go ride harder and crash, but have this thing inflate around us to help us to sort of bounce down the mountain instead of thud the way that I normally do.
And laugh about it.
After. Oh, yeah. It would be great. Yeah, it'd be great. Yeah, you bounce when you're a teenager, but then you don't bounce when you're 40 plus.
You break.
Exactly. All right, Dale. Well, yeah. It's been an honor as always. Thank you very much for your time, buddy. And we'll see you down the road.
I'm very grateful for the chance. Yeah, I'm very grateful for the chance to have chatted with both of you. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of the Kraken Backs Podcast. We hope you enjoyed, and make sure you follow our Instagram at Kraken Backs Podcast. Catch new episodes every Monday. See you next time.